Great to have you with us on Wisconsin Public Radio News. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to start the show today by talking about some efforts to track fish in the Great Lakes, part of a big research project. And our guest is Christopher Vandergroot. Chris is director of the Great Lakes Acoustic Telemetry Observation System. And we'll find out about that system and a whole lot more about Great Lakes fish management as we talk with him. And I hope you'll join in. Are you concerned maybe about fish populations in the Great Lakes, especially Lake Michigan, Lake Superior, maybe Lake Erie if you're a walleye fisherman in particular? You give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Chris Vandergroot, welcome to the show. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Well, good morning, Larry, and I appreciate you inviting me on.
You know, acoustic telemetry, that's part of the name of the group. And maybe we should just start out with a description of what the heck is acoustic telemetry.
Okay, sure. So like if you watch, you know, a nature show and you watch them tracking like bears or elk or whatnot, they typically use what we would refer to as radio telemetry. That's where an animal is given a collar or a transmitter, and the way they track them is using radio waves. Well, acoustic telemetry actually works underwater. So the fish that we are tracking and watching move around the Great Lakes Basin actually have a transmitter attached to them, either externally or internally using a surgical procedure. And then there are a bunch of receivers deployed throughout the Great Lakes Basin. So if you're in Lake Erie, there are quite a few acoustic receivers deployed there. Yeah. And if you're in, other areas like Southern Lake Michigan, there aren't a whole lot there. So in order to track the movements of these fish, there needs to be an acoustic receiver deployed underwater to monitor if a fish is moving around in the area. And I'll just note that it differs from satellite telemetry, which like if you're watching Discovery Channel or something like that, where they're tracking the sharks, most of the times those are using a GPS satellites to track the movements around. So we're not using satellites. Again, this is acoustic telemetry where you have individual transmitters and receivers, and they have to be underwater in order for those signals to be transmitted and then received.
Well, I want to talk some more about those, but first let's talk about the system itself, the Great Lakes Acoustic Telemetry Observation System. And how did it get started? What's the history? I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, so let's start in 2010. In 2010, funding from the Great Lakes Research Initiative was secured by the Great Lakes Fishery Commission, the GLFC, to kind of demonstrate the potential of using acoustic telemetry to tag and monitor fish in the Great Lakes Basin. So this all started with four projects and, you know, a couple hundred receivers. The four projects revolved around walleye, lake sturgeon, lake trout, and then sea lamprey, which of course I'm sure you're familiar are invasive to the Great Lakes. And so the reason for this was is they wanted to be able to get, you know, information on these native fish populations, and then as well as use telemetry to understand the movements of sea lamprey to better inform control efforts.
And it's grown from there, from four to now. I was looking on your site there. There's a heck of a lot of projects going on.
There are. To be quite honest with you, I think, you know, we didn't understand. I think we understood the potential, but what we really didn't grasp was how much the managers, you know, found value in this. So I work for Michigan State University as a researcher, and this project where this collaborative is funded through the Great Lakes Fishery Commission. So the Great Lakes Fishery Commission helps coordinate research on the Great Lakes Basin. But it's the individual management agencies that have the management authority that set regulations and things of that nature. So really what we've found through time is that the managers have found great utility in using this technology. So back in 2010, I was actually a fisheries biologist for the Ohio Department of Natural Resources working on Lake Erie. And my questions were kind of pretty simple. How many of these fish migrate out of Lake Erie? And then what are their survival rates? I didn't really care about all the, you know, fancy things we're finding out, like the thermal use, you know, and things of that nature. My objectives were pretty simple. But I think that kind of hit on, you know, the fact that we could use acoustic telemetry to address management questions and needs that the traditional fishery surveys were not able to address. You know, if you go out and drag a trawl, you might see how many fish are in an area, or if you set, you know, an experimental gill net, or you do some electrofishing. These are just basically taking a snapshot. By tagging these fish and monitoring their movements, you know, we're getting a very good idea of what these fish are doing on very short time frames. Like, and sometimes we are seeing these things every 2 minutes when they're in an area where there's a lot of receiver, and we can actually estimate the precise location of those fish. In other areas, depending upon the array, we're seeing these fish every 2 to 3 to 4 weeks. So, I mean, think about this. You can understand where a fish is in a small area every minute, you know, how long as the fish is there, like how it's moving around a reef when it's there to spawn or in a river, you know, or we can track an individual walleye in the case of Lake Erie or Green Bay, get an idea where they are every 2 weeks for 4 years, as long as that battery lasts. And then when we're tracking things like lake sturgeon, they can handle a much larger tag. So now you know where that lake sturgeon is, say every 2 to 3 weeks for 10 years. So this is just giving the fisheries biologists insight into the ecology, the biology, and the population dynamics of these fish that is unprecedented, to be quite honest with you, particularly in the Great Lakes Basin.
Yeah, if you go on to that site, I was amazed at looking at Erie and Huron and Ontario. I mean, it looks like those lakes are completely covered with telemetry devices. And then in Michigan, I mean, there's spots, you know, concentrated spots in Lake Michigan and in Lake Superior.
Yeah. You want to know the reason for that?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So like in Lake Erie and Lake Huron and Lake Ontario, they're studying fish that have a very broad movement patterns, right? Like we find Lake Erie can move from one end of the lake to the other in a matter of a few weeks, 2 weeks. And in fact, if a fish really gets the unction to go, they can go down there in a couple of days. Well, it goes back to what species we're monitoring. So like in Lake Huron, we're monitoring lake trout, lake whitefish, walleye. These are very large, expansive movement patterns. So that's why the entire lake is what we call wired. And so those receivers are anywhere from 10 to 15 kilometers apart, you know, in the open basin. And then in some of the smaller, you know, like in the western end of Lake Erie or in Green Bay, they're more dense, right? And in Saginaw Bay. Now in Lake Michigan is a little bit interesting and a little bit different than the other lakes because, you know, the open waters of Lake Michigan is, you know, I don't mean to sound negative, but like the open waters are like a bathtub, right? In terms of there's not much productivity there, very clear. Contrast that with Green Bay, where there's a lot of nutrients. It's more like a farm pond. So what we find is that the fish densities are highest in like Green Bay, and that's where a lot of the activity is. And then on the other side of the lake, of course, in Traverse Bay, very similar situation. Out in the open water, we don't think and we don't seem to see much movement of like walleye into the main lake of the basin. That's really more for like where the salmon are running around. And so thus far, there really aren't many salmon projects other than in Lake Ontario in the Great Lakes. And so I, as the need or the interest increases for salmon, I could see that, you know, the arrays expanding in Lake Michigan, very similar to what you see in the other lakes. Right now, we're at a kind of almost at a capacity issue. We've almost tapped our abilities to deploy and maintain receivers. And we do that with the great assistance of the large vessel program through the U.S. Great Lakes Science Center, which is actually stationed in Ann Arbor, Michigan, as well as the different management agencies, Wisconsin DNR, Michigan DNR, and so on and so forth across the basin.
Our guest today, Chris Vandergroot, he's director of the Great Lakes Acoustic Telemetry Observation System, and they're doing some really cool work in all of our Great Lakes in monitoring fish movements and activities. Questions for him, maybe about the project itself or maybe just about the fish. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And, of course, we'd love to hear from you. How are the devices that are in the water, how are they? Are they wired up together? They're not wired up together, I'm sure. They got to be standing alone somehow, aren't they?
That's correct. So when you're talking about telemetry and acoustic telemetry, there's two major categories we have. We have what we call passive receivers and active receivers. Active receivers were literally, we would go out to the river or to on the lake somewhere, drop a receiver in the water and listen for that signal, much like you would do like with the radio telemetry, where you see them waving that big wand around, you know, the one that we used to have on top of our houses way back when, right? So, you don't have that wand because you're not looking through for the signal through the air, of course, with acoustic telemetry, but you literally would just drop that hydrophone down in the water and listen. With the passive receivers, what we do is we generally deploy these on the lake bottom. So there's a couple different ways we would deploy them. Either A, we deploy them where there's a mooring and then there's a long rope and then another mooring or another anchor. And the receiver's deployed on one of those moorings, and then we'll drift through and snag that line, pull everything up to the boat, up in the boat, download the data, change out the batteries, and put the device back down. Or they have what we call acoustic releases built into them, where we'll deploy the unit, it will sit there, we'll go back, send a code, the unit will come back up to the surface, we'll download the data, change out the batteries, and then redeploy it. So it's kind of like having the passive telemetry is kind of like having somebody, and forgive this analogy, sitting under the water with a pair of glasses looking to see who's passing by. So the way this conceptually works, I'm sure you're familiar in the Chicago area with like the Easy Pass system, or on the tolls and whatnot. So think of yourself as a fish, and you've been tagged. If you have one of those little transducers in your car, a little box, and then the toll booths or where you're driving under are the actual receivers. And so we're able to get an idea of where fish go if they get within a certain vicinity of each of these receivers. And then that varies. If you have a very small tag, that tag may only be heard a couple hundred meters away. And if you have a very large tag, like I was talking about with the lake sturgeon, that may be up to a kilometer or a kilometer and a half away, depending upon the water conditions. Where the water is very clear and is not turbid, meaning it doesn't have a lot of dissolved stuff in it, not the farm pond, detection range is usually really good. And then when you have like the more productive systems where there's more stuff in the water, then the detection range is a lot less, it's reduced. And then it also depends like with boat noise. Like if we're doing work in the spring where guys are walleye fishing on the reefs, I can't hear any tags going off because the underwater sound from the transducers actually is actually interfering with the signal, and we can't hear the fish real well. So again, because it's underwater, it's subject to the properties that kind of either enhance or thwart sound moving through the water column.
Chris Vandergroot, that's really cool. Chris Vandergroot is director of the Great Lakes Acoustic Telemetry Observation System, taking a look at fish and fish movements in our Great Lakes and we haven't zeroed in on any of them, but we're probably most interested in Michigan and Superior, but and Erie, because there are a lot of walleye fishermen out there who travel to Lake Erie for that. You can join in. What questions do you have about fish in the Great Lakes? The number is 800-642-1234. You can email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. having some fun today talking about some research going on in the Great Lakes with Chris Vandergroot. He directs the Great Lakes Acoustic Telemetry Observation System. Again, questions about the fish of the Great Lakes or about the research, I hope you'll join in. Number's 800-642-1234. Or email to talk at WPR.org. I was kind of amused as I was reading online your paper. You were talking about the writing about the telemetry, the systems, and they said they're designed to minimize interference with all other projects. And then in parentheses, it said destructive tag collisions.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered what the heck that was.
Wow, you really want to get in the weeds today, don't you? Yeah. So the way that works actually is if you have too many fish in an area that are tagged, the signals collide with one another and they literally will knock each other out, just like bumper cars. So if you have one fish in an area, it takes a second or two for that tag to actually transmit so that the receiver can receive it and decode it. But if you have a lot of fish in a small area, it's kind of like going to like a, I don't know, some type of event, you know, in a big hall where you can't hear anything. You know, you can only hear what's really close by you. You got a lot of noise competing, right? So that's exactly what it works in. So what my job is as director is to kind of coordinate among these projects to make sure that not too many fish are being tagged in a defined in a small area so that it's interfering with the objectives of other projects. And so I use the word objectives because all these projects, it's not like, hey, I wonder what walleye do, or I wonder what lake trout do. Each of these projects have a specific and a unique set, sometimes overlapping, of objectives of what they're trying to accomplish with their project. And so we don't want one project interfering with the objectives of another project.
That makes a lot of sense to me. I as I was looking at some of the projects, I thought one had to do with estimating metabolic rates in walleye, and I thought, how the heck, you know, estimating metabolic rates in a fish, you typically have to have some sort of closed system, if I'm not mistaken. And pressure and so forth. So,
yeah. So you're kind of right on. You're right on cue there. So there's two components, I believe, to that study. So one is actually seeing what these fish are doing out in the lake. And so these transmitters, we talked about the transmitters emit this code, and it goes out, right, and it says, "Here I am." Well, some of these transmitters also have unique sensors built into them. And so one of these sensors is an accelerometer sensor. So it tells how fast a fish is swimming at a given point. So every time that fish transmits a signal, it's also sending a little piece of data that says, and by the way, this is how fast I'm moving. So that what they use is they use how fast the fish are moving at those different areas and or out for the course of a day, a week, or a month. And then at the same time, some of these transmitters actually have the ability to record depth. Like there's a pressure sensor on it so I can tell how deep in the water column they are, whether the fish are near the bottom or up near the surface, or if that varies, you know, what we call horizontal movements. They also have temperature sensors. So I don't actually do research anymore. I sit down and make sure everybody keeps playing nicely and do email and fill out budget. So these researchers can say, hey, what temperature is this fish occupying? And how does that change? And so like in a place like Lake Superior, you know, during the summer, it's pretty much the same temperature from bottom to surface to the bottom, right? Because it's the lake is mixed. You know, where they are in the water column, you're probably gonna get a very similar temperature reading. Contrast that with like Green Bay or Lake Erie or Lake Huron, where the lake stratifies, where there's warm water and then cold water. So if a fish is at one location, we don't know if it doesn't have a depth sensor on it, whether it's near the surface or at the bottom. So combining the temperature data and the pressure data gives us a better idea of what their behavior and what their activity looks like. And so, again,
interesting.
It's mind-blowing. And to blow your mind maybe just a hair bit more, they actually came out a few years ago with a sensor that is a digestion sensor. So that when we're tagging like smolts and they're starting to reintroduce Cisco into the Great Lakes. Yeah. The Cisco were once the forage base. So we put these transmitters in these smaller fish, even in yellow perch. If they're eaten, as that fish is being digested by the predator, there's a little enzyme on that transmitter. And when that enzyme, when the stomach enzymes digest the transmitter, it emits a new code. So now it's basically saying, it says, I've been eaten. So now we know when we're able to determine when that fish was at liberty and then when that fish was in captivity in the stomach of a predator. And so while this is really cool, right, you can only imagine how this information can be used by managers for estimating like stocking survival rates. Hey, how many of these fish are we releasing are actually, you know, surviving to whatever endpoint we're interested in? And if predation is an issue in this area or with this type of stocking, maybe we can modify our stocking practices. So maybe we stock offshore instead of onshore. Maybe we stock at night instead of during the day and vice versa. So this information, again, it goes back to what are the management questions and how can we help them address them?
I'm wondering, you know, the whole tagging process, do you have any sense on mortality and the tagging process itself and that sort of thing?
Yeah, it depends who's doing it. No. So that's one of the things we do is like, so whenever you tag a fish, right, your assumption is that a tagged fish behaves just like the other fish out there. So generally when you tag a fish, you actually what we call censor the data. We generally don't look at what it's doing for the first, you know, maybe, you know, few days or a few, you know, a couple weeks, because there's an assumption that it may have affected the behavior of that fish, right? And so if we're tracking an individual fish and we see that it doesn't move, we can assume, oh, that fish died. But if we see that fish either moving upstream or moving across the bay and whatnot, we're like, hey, this fish survived the tagging process. So typically researchers, once they get their data back, they're trying to get an idea of like, you know, how much of an impact did that process have on the fish? And then, you know, that of course determines how many fish you have at liberty.
Rodney emailed to ask how warming temperatures are affecting fish populations and if there are people studying that.
Yes. So like there are, you know, what are the effects of climate change, right? And, you know, what does it mean for the future? So that's a difficult question to answer because, you know, they're going to be fish populations are going to be affected differently. In general, younger fish actually prefer warmer water, right? They grow quicker. And, you know, it's like northern pike. Northern pike are typically considered to be a cold water fish or a cool water fish. But actually, when they're young, they love the warm water. So there are no conclusive results yet. But with respect to how, you know, changing temperatures may affect this. But a lot of these projects are trying to get an idea of, like, what is the spatial temporal that's in time and space distribution of these fish, you know, throughout their life cycle. So we don't have anything, you know, really conclusive yet, but that is how this telemetry is being used. And then the immediate, you know, questions we can ask are like, hey, because if lakes are warming up quicker, are they having to migrate longer distances to find that cold water refuge? And then does that negatively impact their survival? You know, everybody thought, you know, with the warming temperatures, you know, Lake Walleye and Lake Erie were going to be in a lot of trouble. But if you actually look at the recruitment records over the last decade, Lake Erie Walleye have been doing very, very well. A lot of strong hatches. So it's one of those things where we don't know exactly what the impact is because it's likely going to vary for different life stages. And then, of course, with different species that are under consideration.
Yeah, here in Wisconsin, we're losing a lot of walleye. We're losing our walleye populations at the and probably at the expense of bass, smallies, smallmouth bass, and are increasing in numbers while walleye populations are diminishing. And, of course, I'm not talking about the Great Lakes here, but it's a real concern for many, many people.
Yeah, I'm familiar with quite a bit of that research. I believe University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, have been working on quite a bit of that research. They're actually very active in most of the telemetry projects in Green Bay. So yeah, yep, it is definitely a new phenomena. I think there's similar observations up in Canada, and seeing where this goes will certainly be interesting. I mean, keep in mind these systems are always very dynamic; they're not static, and so there's ebbs and flows. But it will be interesting to see how this plays out over the longer term.
I want to talk about some of the other individual research projects that are going on. So there's a lot of cool ones. I'm really a muskie fisherman. I caught a lot of muskies in my life. And I'm always, I'm hopeful that maybe we'll get a world record out of Green Bay someday. There's some pretty big ones being caught there, but I know there's a muskie... the Green Bay Fox River research project, I think that relates to muskie spawning.
Yeah, I have to admit that with all those projects, I am not as, probably in tune with all the the aspects of, that project. But you're right. It's looking at, I believe where they're spawning, and then also like what these fish are doing when temperatures maybe get too warm, for them to be in those shallow water environments. The muskie are interesting because, and they're actually a little bit of a challenge for our acoustic telemetry array, because if you take a look at your at those maps that you were referencing on our website, most of those receivers are deployed in the open water. When you get near shore and in shallow water, especially where there's a lot of vegetation, that's where the acoustic telemetry has a little bit more challenges. Because again, there's vegetation in the water and it thwarts the signal. So with that said, because we have such the wide coverage, if those fish are making cross bay movements, or even if they're only detected opportunistically, I think it has the opportunity to provide a lot of insight into their ecology. I know bringing it back maybe a little bit to Lake Erie real quick in the St. Clair system, quite a few walleye muskies that have been tagged in the St. Clair system have actually been detected in Lake Erie, and they almost like swim a lap around the lake and then go back out. And likely, they're out there searching for forage and also suitable temperatures. So it's really interesting. Like that's, again, one of the things, like there's no other tagging approach that could provide the information, that this acoustic telemetry would. Traditionally, biologists would go out, tag a fish with some type of external tag, and then maybe that fish would be recaptured by an angler at some point in the future. And they might know where it is either, 2 weeks after it was captured or 10 years. But it's like a point A and point B data set, right? Whereas with the telemetry, there's A, B, C, D, E, F, and a lot of different data points.
Well, let's say I catch a 60-inch muskie, and it's got a, or anybody else catches a tagged fish. I'm trying to think of a way that you'd be able to get that information or that data to you or whoever's doing the research.
Sure. So there's two ways that fish, you might know if that fish is marked. Now, let me just say from the onset, not all the fish that are tagged with these acoustic transmitters, are marked so that an angler would know it. Certainly if an angler were to cut a fish open, the transmitter would fall out if it's attached internally. But there are some studies where there's very low exploitation rates. And so, you wouldn't expect to catch one of these. So typically, if a researcher feels like their fish is going to potentially be harvested, like a walleye, like a white fish, like a lake trout, and I believe they're even doing this with smallmouth bass, they will put an extra tag in that fish, an external tag that protrudes out of the abdomen, under the stomach, and will say reward. And then they typically will offer $100, and then there will be a number to call that tag in. So what we encourage anglers to do is don't do anything that you wouldn't normally do, right? So if you never have thrown a legal walleye back in the water. Now, I know I'm on a Wisconsin show. I'd say that, that the chances of that are probably pretty high, right, Larry?
Yeah.
I mean, legal walleye rarely go back. Then we wouldn't want you to throw back that walleye with a transmitter, because we're able to actually use that information to say, hey, this is what our exploitation rates are. So we just want anglers to behave in the way that they typically would. So like if you've never ever harvested a smallmouth bass, then I would say don't harvest the smallmouth bass, put it back if it looks healthy. Now you could report the tag, because on the tag there's another little identifier, you know, and that would allow the researcher to know, oh, hey, I tagged that one on this day and it's still swimming around. So I guess, you know, in general, I can't speak for every researcher, but in generally we encourage anglers just to behave, if you would, the way they normally would. If you would normally harvest the fish, harvest it. If you don't, just release it and let it go.
I had some thoughts about managing and how managers might use the information that they receive. I was thinking about that Green Bay Fox River one with muskie spawning. If they can see where there are areas where eggs are being produced, you know, from a management perspective, look, okay, here's some areas where they're being produced, but they're not being produced over here. Why is that? Or how can we make this area even better for fish to actually lay their eggs?
You're absolutely right. So that's the whole impetus behind this, these type of studies. Again, depending upon what type of receiver configuration we're using. And so now we'll talk about a fine scale positioning, when I mentioned before, where I said we could estimate the coordinates of where a fish were, you know, its latitude and longitude versus the presence absence. So, you know, theoretically, like you say, if you had a bunch of receivers in this spawning habitat and we, you know, the researcher saw that it focused on this weed line or this type of habitat, they could say, oh, this seems to be very conducive. And so can we enhance that? Or can we, when we're designing new habitats, this is what we want to look at. A couple examples there. One is actually up in Lake Superior, where they were looking at restoring wild rice in some of the beds. They were looking at ways actually of how they could exclude carp, because carp are very destructive to wild rice. You know, and then what effect the carp had on the wild rice. So they were, you know, looking at their fine scale movements in and around the beds of wild rice. In Lake Erie, they had no idea where lake trout were spawning. And what they found is that they were actually spawning in habitats they weren't exactly expecting. Is that, yeah, they were spawning on the reef, but they were actually spawning on the leeward side on a much steeper slope than they would have expected. So it's really giving biologists more insight into like what type of habitat these fish are utilizing. Every biologist has some type of working idea of what they use, but the beauty of this is you're letting the fish tell you exactly what they're using.
Really interesting. Chris Vandergroot, our guest today, director of the Great Lakes Acoustic Telemetry Observation System. Questions for him about the fish in the Great Lakes or about this research project, I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address, talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio News. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at high-tech fish tracking and high-tech EV charging stations on the show today, but we're zeroing in now on the fish tracking with our guest, Christopher Vandergroot. Chris is director of the Great Lakes Acoustic Telemetry Observation System, operating throughout our Great Lakes. And we're talking about, really talking about the projects that are going on there. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions about fish or the fisheries in the Great Lakes. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you can email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. As I looked at the projects going on, we've got, you know, of course I zeroed in on the muskie spawning on Lake Michigan, but there's also lake trout spawning in Lake Michigan. There's also whitefish taking a look at whitefish mortality and also Cisco, which is a big deal for a lot of reasons you may want to talk about.
Yeah, so let's start with the lake whitefish. Lake whitefish, you know, have had some pretty large population declines throughout the Great Lakes Basin, not just Lake Michigan, yeah. Lake Huron, Lake Erie. I think Lake Superior is actually holding fairly constant. I sometimes get them mixed up. But anyway, Lake Whitefish, you know, have had declines. And this is a pretty big concern, you know, A, from the ecological role that they fill, but also they're also a very popular food fish, right? Like who doesn't love smoked whitefish?
Yep.
You know, when you're traveling. So there's a great concern there. And so one of the things the researchers are doing, again, are trying to understand, you know, what are their survival rates? That's one of the things we use the telemetry data for, is that we're able to estimate survival rates by saying, hey, how many are alive at year 1, 2, 3, and 4? And so then why are those fish dying? Are they dying due to natural causes like disease or predation or something like that? Or are they dying due to fishing causes, right? So if they're dying due to associated with fishing, well, then harvest regulations can be amended and we can address those declines that way. If it's, due to disease and natural mortality, that's another, you know, presents another set of challenges. But really, biologists want to know why the fish are dying. So that's one of the reasons the telemetry is being done on the with Lake Whitefish. What's interesting, it sounds like they a lot of work is being done there in Green Bay. It sounds like, you know, there's fish that run up the rivers to spawn, and then there's also fish that utilize the main lake. So very interesting comparisons. And then with respect to the Cisco, like you mentioned, you want a 60-pound muskie in Green Bay. You want to root for a Cisco coming back, because those little things are very high in calorie, and they're usually very abundant, you know, when you've got good populations. And everything eats them. So again, that's the focus. And what's the interesting about Cisco is that there's what we call different phenotypes, or they do different things. There are some Cisco that are very shallow, near shore. Those were historically referred to as Lake Herring in Lake yeah. Erie. Then there are the deep water forms. Those are like your bloaters and things like that. So there are Ciscos that occupy the near shore environments, and then there are Cisco that occupy the offshore pelagic environment. So that's, again, managers and researchers are using the telemetry to better understand, you know, the habitat use of these different forms, and then as well as, you know, different stocking strategies. They're being reintroduced pretty actively in Green Bay right now, the Cisco. There are a lot of bloater being reintroduced into Lake Ontario. Lake Erie, I think, has also entered the discussion on trying to maybe reintroducing them. So there's quite a bit of work focusing on bringing back the Cisco. I mean, think about yeah. it. It's what they eat. You want yeah. native. You would want to have native forage for these fish to eat, and that provides the most stable forage base. And that's the role that Cisco fill in the Great Lakes ecosystem.
Yeah, very, very important. Ryan in Columbus has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Ryan. Thanks for calling.
Hey, guys. Very interested in this topic. I had a question about fish tagging, and I am a strictly catch and release fisherman, and I've always been curious if I'm catching the same fish or not. Probably the running joke. But is it possible to get trained or get materials, tagging equipment and get training to learn how to tag fish?
I'd have to have you refer to the, or it would be smart for me to refer you to the local management agencies that are doing the work. They typically have scientific sampling permits, you know, to do this work. Now, I will say a majority of the fish that receive these tags, we bring them on board once we catch them. We'll immobilize them or anesthetize them so that they're not, you know, flailing about. And then we need to suture these fish back up and release them. So it's quite involved, you know, actually. But I would say you should probably reach out to the individual researchers at the different state agencies who are conducting these studies.
Yeah, I've known guys who have clipped a fin or something and done some sort of way to do it that way, Ryan, but that's has its dangers too. But it's not a bad idea. The DNR, Wisconsin DNR, might be the place to go for some more information on that for sure. Chris, thank you for calling. Christina in Glenwood, will go to you. What's on your mind?
Hi there, thank you. I'm wondering, what, if anything, have you learned about how the lamprey affects the fish population?
Yeah, that's been an ongoing my whole career when it comes to the Great Lakes.
So that's actually really interesting. With respect to how the lamprey affect the fish population, the telemetry hasn't really focused on that too much. It's been focusing more on what are the ways to better control these fish. So the telemetry has been used to say, hey, what's the efficiency of these different traps that are being used? Because a lot of times they use these traps up in the tributaries when these things go to spawn, and they try to collect them there. And what there's been some really neat research where they've actually developed these pheromones that will either draw lamprey to one river where they can be trapped, or it repels them from others. So there's like a death pheromone and, you know, as you would say, an attraction pheromone. So the telemetry has been used to kind of evaluate these different approaches and then which one is most effective. I've been talking with the Great Lakes Fishery Commission and some of the folks who head up that research, and we think the time is now right, meaning we have enough receivers in some of these lakes where we could tag simultaneously sea lamprey and the fish that they typically impact, like whitefish and lake trout, and learn more how these two fish kind of move throughout the ecosystem together. So there's not been too much work on the direct effect of lamprey on these fish populations with the telemetry. It's more understanding the ecology of the lamprey and how they can tailor control efforts to control them.
You know, I'm thinking about the lampreys. It seems to me, and I'm thinking of over the course of my career here on Wisconsin Public Radio, from time to time it's come up, and I remember maybe back to when I first started, there seemed to be more concern. I mean, it seemed like the lampreys hit a peak at some point and then started going declining a bit. I don't know what you have in mind, Chris, what information you have on that and sort of the history of it.
Well, my supervisor is probably cringing right now because I am not a lamprey guy. But again, I've been involved with fisheries management in the Great Lakes since the early 2000s. And so each state or each lake has its target wounding rate on different fish. And typically it's lake trout or lake whitefish. Lake whitefish actually don't think they sustain a lamprey attack very well. Like that, they probably die very quickly. But fish like lake trout can actually sustain an attack. And what they do is they look at like what fraction of the population has these scars from lamprey. So each lake has their own target levels. Now, I'll say the work that the Great Lakes Fishery Commission does in conjunction with both the Canadian and U.S. Governments to control these lamprey is impressive. There are crews that go out throughout the basin and implement control efforts every year, and they're out there right now. By and large, right now, those across the Great Lakes, I believe they're meeting their objective, like of keeping those attack rates low. So they have an idea of like, hey, when attack rates get too high, that's when we see a lot of fish mortality, and they kind of keep they shoot for some background level of marking rates, because the reality is they're never going to exclude all of them, because they're kind of spawning in some of these different smaller tributaries they may not know. But they're actively working when there's flare-ups in these different lakes and targeting those to keep them at, you know, if you could say, acceptable levels. I mean, one could argue no level is acceptable, mm-hmm. but the reality of the matter is that they're not going to be able to eradicate all of them. And so they're strategically working to keep these populations suppressed in each lake.
Wow. It's something we don't hear as very much or as much about as we once did, for sure. Which, as you look at thinking about the Great Lakes, which fish do you think are most in trouble?
Which ones are most in trouble? Well, right now, the news on Lake Whitefish is somewhat disconcerting. The recruitment patterns, that is the number of young fish that are showing up in the surveys, is pretty low. The question is that due to, again, things like fishing or climate change, or is it kind of the result of zebra mussels working their way up the lakes? If you recall, zebra mussels were first identified, I believe, in Lake Erie, you know, way back when.
Yeah.
And they've been slowly making their way up into the upper lakes. And I think the concern in the upper lakes is you already have reduced nutrients in the upper lakes because you don't have as much agricultural area. And so whatever nutrients are there are what juvenile lake whitefish, as well as other fish, need to survive. And so the thought there is that if zebra mussels get in and reduce those nutrients even further, that could be very detrimental. There's no smoking gun. There's still a lot of research ongoing, but that is one of the current hypotheses being evaluated.
Yeah, zebra mussels are awful. Are there any others along with zebra mussels that are creating problems for the fishery?
You know, it's interesting you say that because I remember when I started on Lake Erie, everybody was really, really concerned about gobies. You know, they had just gotten in. And the reality of it is of course, the population of gobies skyrocketed. But then the funny thing is that everything learned, these are pretty good to eat. And then you start seeing them in all sorts of fish diets. And now, you know, again, you don't see the high abundance of gobies in Lake Erie like you used to, because the predators have figured out, oh, we can eat these. And so I think that's kind of been a similar scenario that's been playing itself out. As they come in, fish figure out how to eat them. I think one of the most troublesome, aside from the Asian carp, topic, the common carp are actually fairly detrimental. And I don't think people realize that just because we've had them for so many years. And the detriment of them is that they go into these near shore areas that are very sensitive, and they're just constantly uprooting the vegetation, which increases the turbidity of the water, which decreases the amount of light that's penetrating, which then decreases the amount of phytoplankton and zooplankton, which young fish need to survive. So, you know, I would say if there's one on my hit list, I would say common carp probably are more the biggest ecological disaster, you know, that, you know, aside from the alewives, you know, that were back in the 50s and so on, you know, when they proliferated, you know, current day, I would say, you know, the big heads and silvers carp, we definitely don't want to see them here. But modern day, I would say common carp are pretty rough for the environment.
Yeah, and I know we do netting in the lake systems, the inland lake system. It'd be a lot harder to do it in the Great Lakes, and I don't imagine.
They do it in places like Lake Erie. They have big seine operations, and I'm convinced you could put a saddle on some of those carp that they haul up because they are very, very large. Anyway.
How do people find out more about the GLaDOS, or the Great Lakes Acoustic Telemetry Observation System?
So the easiest way would just to be to type GLaDOS in your search or your browser, GLATOS. If you want to go directly to the site, you can go to glados.gloss.us. So that would be glados.glos.us, and that will take you to the webpage. The webpage is pretty boring in some respects because it's really built for the researchers where they're uploading their data and where they're archiving their data. But there, as you discovered, there's quite a few project descriptions on there.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting to me, and I know it will be to a lot of other people as well. Chris, a great pleasure. Thank you for taking a whole hour to talk with us. I really appreciate it, and maybe we can do this again down the road. Thank you, Chris.
Anytime. Appreciate you having us on.
Chris Vandergroot is the director of the Great Lakes Acoustic Telemetry Observation System. Well, coming up, we're going to be taking a look at Wisconsin's new alternative fuel corridor. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News.